Some of you that are watching this, maybe even online, are little kids. I think maybe even my grandkids are watching. And maybe someday this information, even though they're very, very young, may resonate. But it's a kind of a history lesson tied in with Bible prophecy. And a number of historians have said through the years, the Durants said it, there are Will and Ariel Durant, and there are others that said the same thing, that those who do not learn the lessons of history are doomed to repeat them. So there have been a number of different people that have said that same thing, and a number of people are attributed or given attribution to that quote. But I think that we can all relate to that, that if you don't understand the historical context of life, then it's possible that human beings could make the same errors. Not you, of course, but I think it's just a good learning point for all of us. The presidential inauguration is coming up in a couple of days, and it ties in with what I'll be speaking in today. And I go back to the time of the first inauguration that I remember in 1961, and in Washington, D.C., on January 20th, 1961, it was bitter cold. It was bitter, bitter cold. And still, the Capitol was packed, and there are all kinds of people sitting around. And I'll show you some of the pictures of those folks. But we lived only 55 miles from Washington, D.C. I lived in a little town called Thurmont, Maryland. You can look it up. The phrase for the town itself was Gateway to the Mountains, and it was a gateway to the Blue Ridge Mountain chain, lay right at the foot of it and right at the base of the same mountain range where Camp David still is, the presidential retreat that many of you have heard of and read about. But our weather was Washington, D.C.'s weather. And it was really a very, very memorable time. I have some of the memories from back in the day. This is a picture. I'm surprised that the picture came out this good. This is our house in Thurmont, Maryland, a couple of days before the inauguration. It was beautiful at that time because you get this point at which the snow is coming down and it's all gray outside and you can't really see. You know what that's like, right? In your homeland. And it's beautiful. You just sit in the cozy house and maybe you got the fire going and you can see our chimney. We probably had a fire going at that time. And you just sit by and you watch. There's nothing you can do. You can't really travel. So we just see the snow softly falling down. It was probably, the camera didn't pick up the snowflakes there, but it was, you can see one of the pine trees in our yard was just, about to fall down with the branches filled with snow. So it was a very, very heavy snowstorm. And then it cleared up on Inauguration Day in 1961. But for several days, I remember this so much as a kid, for several days and even weeks afterwards, we had so much snowfall. And when the snow plows came through, they piled up the snow in front of the house. Then you had to dig your way out of the driveway and all of that. And of course, Dad did all of that. But there was so much snow that it was probably, I mean, to an 8-year-old at that time, seemed like 12 feet high, but it wasn't. But it was probably 5 or 6 feet high. And we dug tunnels into those snowdrifts, and those tunnels and those little forts that we built inside lasted for weeks because it was so frigid cold. And then it got all hard as ice and everything. So this cute little guy here was there to see it all. Really, somebody should have taken better care of that photo there, that cute little guy, 8 years old. You can see one of the things that I was wearing at that time was an innovation. The thing that would save mankind so much time through the years, the clip-on tie. And it was one of those great inventions that came out at the end of the 50s and the 60s, and it has endured today. It is an incredible, incredible thing. It has been one of the great achievements of the 20th century. But a number of other time-saving devices of those years, like the tube of toothpaste, etc. Anyway, the 1960 election was hotly, hotly contested. Here are the results between President Nixon and President Kennedy. You can see that there was, very, very little difference between the votes. And even, as I'll show you in a second, it was so hotly contested that it came down to the difference between two pivotal states in terms of electoral votes, the Electoral College. It was, but you can see it was just like the closest, one of the closest elections of all time in American history. And it was one of those things that there were questions about it. For those of you that were alive at that particular time and you remember that election, you remember there were questions that came up at that time as to, okay, what happened in a couple of states? For those of you that are younger, maybe there's a history lesson you never got in school, but here's the margin of victory, the popular national margin of victory with over 60 million votes cast. Of course, the population, much less at that time, was only 119,000 votes. That's pretty slim margin. And in Texas, there were, at that time, it was a smaller population state, even, believe it or not, than Illinois. They only had 24 electoral votes at that particular time. I think it's 40 or 50 now, but then Illinois had 27 electoral votes. Illinois was a bigger state in terms of population than Texas then. Not the same now. But in Texas, there was a 257 difference. And in Illinois, only 8,000, just a little less than 9,000 votes separated. And there were all kinds of claims and problems of shenanigans. There's a small county in South Texas called Farr County, P-H-A-R-R, and there was the accusation that so many dead Hispanic voters voted in that election that the Farr County Courthouse, where all the records were kept, and there were no computers back then, it was all on paper, burned down very quickly, as very, very shortly afterwards, a freak accident. Burned down the entire courthouse and everything in it, and all the records and all the votes, and they were never able to examine those. And then there were the accusations at that time of the Democrat machine in Chicago, Illinois, with Mayor Mayor Daley rigged the election and brought in the difference of the votes in Chicago. So that was a, you know, some things never change, right? That was a hotly contested election at that particular time. But what might have been? You know, the Texas and Illinois vote, 51 electoral votes. Kennedy had, in the end, 303 electoral votes, and Nixon had 219. But there were people who claimed that Nixon actually won those states. And had he been declared the winner, then he would have had the magic number of 270. So he would have been the president at that particular time. But he wasn't. Now, there are other things that, I mean, some of you are not old enough to remember this, but both President Kennedy and eventually President Nixon both served honorably in World War II, were both veterans. They were both went into Congress. They were both highly thought of. Nixon had been the vice president under President Eisenhower, and he ran as his successor. Both of them were very popular among American voters at that particular time. And President Kennedy had a very photogenic family, a beautiful wife, a couple of cute little kids. And so many people don't understand also that one of the things that was problematic for the Kennedys at that time was because they were Roman Catholics. I don't think we'd ever elected a Roman Catholic to the presidency before, but one of the major threats that was thought of by some Americans in the early 1960s was that because the Kennedy family were Roman Catholic, that somehow or another we might be subject to Rome and the Pope, which is kind of crazy when you think about it now, but it was a real fear that happened at that particular time. You can do some historical search and Google it and take a look at it, but that was one of the things. As it turns out, then, President Kennedy actually, I think most historians would recognize that even if it's true that the election was kind of rigged at that time, a very, very close vote, a lot of people would say he turned out to be a really good president for the short time that he was in, and this is Chief Justice Earl Warren administering the oath of office to President Kennedy. And then in his speech, you can see in the background on the right-hand side, you can see the Vice President Lyndon Johnson and then former Vice President Nixon sitting right next to him. But in this speech, one of the most memorable phrases that President Kennedy challenged the nation with was, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." And those words still are famous words in a famous speech in that inauguration of 1961. So though the election was close, and there were many controversies that arose during those days, there were personal flaws, and a lot of that has come out in the years. My father was privy to some of those personal flaws from with us. It would be later, much later in the decade of the 60s, as one of his best friends was a serviceman who served in the White House chauffeur area, and so he told Dad some stories that, you know, kind of, we never heard this before because the news media didn't report on things like that during those years. But despite the fact that there were some personal flaws, I think most people would look back and say that President Kennedy embodied the American spirit of individualism and entrepreneurship and the kind of putting the nation first attitude. And he challenged individuals, citizens, to achieve. One of the things that President Kennedy was famous for was initiating a presidential campaign for America to be fit and to exercise. And even as a little kid, we were challenged on that by our high school or by our grade school gym teachers because they were patriotic. They wanted to follow the president's viewpoint. And then later on, you know, I found out that you're not even required to take physical education. But back then it was a requirement, grades 1 through 12. had to go to phys ed every day, usually at least close to an hour, 40 minutes to an hour, whatever the class time was. President Kennedy was a charismatic leader. He was charming. You look back and you can Google some of the old press conferences, and he had kind of the same manner that President Reagan did in being able to banter with the press. That's when the press would allow that. He was serious about the threat of communism. One of his most famous speeches, I haven't put it up here, but you can Google it, the speech that he gave in West Berlin in June of 1963, shortly before he was assassinated. And he talked about the fact that communism was still a threat. And then he invoked the famous words, "Ich bin ein Berliner," I am a Berliner, because I am, you know, with you and your quest for freedom as West Berliners. They lived in a free city, the West Berliners, but they were surrounded by East Germany, so there was always the threat that the communists could take control of the part of the city that had been partitioned and given to the West. So it's a speech that you can look up, and I think you'll find it kind of interesting, and it seems a little dated after you go back and just realize everything that has happened in the past 64 years. The Kennedy presidency, this is a personal view a little bit. I know that it happened before that, but it really represented a huge rise of the American power and prominence on the world stage. The nation was still ascending. At least it's my belief that it was. And the last 64 years, a little bold statement here, shocking statement, shows that it still is dominant in the world. That prominence is still there. So while we're on the eve of the next presidential inauguration, America is also led by a leader who wants to reclaim that American birthright. And that's what we're talking about today. The blessings of Abraham. Let's reflect on those profound blessings and where they came from that flowed from the obedience of one man. You can do a deep dive into these passages moving forward, and I hope that you do, but these blessings have extended across time and space for thousands of years, reaching our shores in the United States of America and other nations, as well as we have talked about recently in a number of Bible studies and sermons. The narrative of Abraham, it's not just a historical account. It's a testament to God and his faithfulness and his ability to make true on his promises. So what I want to do is show this, the promises of Abraham, by capturing this little slice of time. And it really is. Even 64 years is a long time, and many of you have not lived that long in your lives, but I have. It's a part of my history. It's a part of the history of a number of you in the audience. So as I've done in the introduction, let's move ahead to the present and the future of God's plan and the blessings that were given originally. We'll go back to Genesis chapter 12, first of all. This is the beginning. It's important to lay the foundation and understand this individual. And again, please feel free to do a deep dive on the life of Abraham. A few chapters, his name is mentioned, but he's one of the most prominent figures in all of the Bible, and everything that we enjoy today, we can trace back to him. I guess you could say, well, God would have dealt with somebody else, and that's probably true, but he did deal with Abraham. And Abraham is a magnificent figure on the biblical stage. So we'll begin in Genesis chapter 12 and verse 1. God calls Abraham to leave his country, his people, his father's household, and just go to someplace different that he would show him. And God's promises to Abraham were manifold, as you know. I will make you into a great nation, verse 1, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. So if you're going to identify the descendants of Abraham, you'd have to find a group of people that have had this kind of effect, not only in their own nation, but on the rest of the entire world. And through history, you can maybe come up with a few potential candidates, but there's no greater candidate than the nation that all of us live in today. Now, have all peoples on earth been blessed exactly or specifically like the United States has? Well, not yet, but a rising tide lifts all boats, and this is not just a promise for the foreseeable future or even the past that we have lived in. It's a promise that will take place in the future going forward. And that's what we really have to be concerned about, because on the horizon is the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. On the horizon is the establishment of the kingdom of God. And the destiny of the United States of America and the destiny of the English-speaking peoples of the world are to become the kind of people that would set the example for everyone else, all peoples on earth. Will be blessed through you. That's what God has decreed, and you can't take that away. Nobody can take that away. This covenant is not only a blessing to Abraham and his initial descendants and for the generations that would follow him, but also a testament to the faithfulness of God, that no matter what, he has fulfilled that promise. Abraham faced a lot of trials and tribulations, and he had flaws, and he had foibles, and he was subject to the same frailties humanly that all of us are, but he did remain obedient to God's calling and demonstrate an unwavering faith during his lifetime. Abraham's journey was marked by some incredible things that he was called upon to do. He was willing to leave everything that was familiar at the time. He had a readiness to trust God despite the impossible circumstances. And it's not just one man that has to be convinced now. It's going to be his wife, and it's going to be moving forward with the rest of his family, very, very difficult things. And then we find, I'm not going to turn there immediately, but in Genesis 22, you have him having to take Isaac and offer him up as his son, knowing that this just doesn't make sense. He knew that instinctively. God said, do this, but this just doesn't seem right. But again, he continued, and I'm sure that it was one of the most difficult of decisions. In Genesis chapter 22, beginning in verse 17, after God says, I don't want you to kill your son, he then says, I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring all nations will be blessed because you have obeyed me. That takes us a little bit into the future from that time forward to the establishment of the nation of Israel, and they would enter the promised land, and that takes care of that. But that promise was passed from Isaac here to then to Jacob in Genesis chapter 26. In Genesis 26 and verse 3, God said to Isaac, he says, dwell in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your descendants I will give all these lands, and I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham, your father, and I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven. I will give to your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. It goes on to the present age and even on to the future, into the wonderful world tomorrow, as we have called it. And in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because Abraham obeyed my voice, kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. And then we've studied a lot of this in going into the life of Jacob recently and everything that God did with his life and with Joseph's life after that. But in Genesis 28 in verse 13, and behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land in which you lie I will give to you and your descendants. Also, your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and the south. So they would colonize and go everywhere all throughout the earth. That's what would happen to the descendants of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob. And in you and your seed, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. A lot of times we think of that just in the here and now, or just from the time of when these blessings began to be manifoldly bestowed upon the English-speaking peoples from the 1800s on. But it goes on forever, doesn't it, when you think about it? It goes on and on and on. Now, you can do a deep dive on looking at the characteristics of Abraham, and in the few short chapters that the Bible is devoted to his life, you see a lot of very admirable traits and qualities, and you can go back and take a look at his courage and his bravery, first in leaving his homeland, then in going after his nephew Lot and going to war actually against a bunch of kings to retrieve his nephew, the compassion that he had for his nephew Lot, and even for the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, and pleading with God, God, if there's 50 righteous men in these areas, will you spare them? After God and his angels had disclosed to them, this is what we're going to do. It's going to be fire from heaven. Oh, look, you know, this is pretty bold, isn't it? If there's 50, yes, I'll relent. I won't bring destruction. What about if there's only 40? And then bringing it all the way down to 10. If there's only 10, God says yes. It's really, that's inspiring. To know that you could talk to God and that God would listen to you and your reasoning, because he was so concerned about his nephew. And then we all know the story about Lot being dragged out by angelic beings out of Sodom and Gomorrah. Incredible. Trustworthy. Abraham was as reliable as it gets in his relationship. He, oh boy, just incredible. His obedience was incredible as well. It was very inspirational. And then his belief or his faith in God's promises was steadfast. And we have been the recipients of that. I mean, I'm going to have some other bold statements at the end. We can discuss those in the chat. Yeah, you know what? We can even argue about those in the chat today. We will have a chat with the messenger, but we can discuss those because it's always good to get different points of view as well. Somebody was telling me a story not too long ago. I don't want to be too specific about it, but we've all seen this, where people may come to the United States for the first time and they see, you know, maybe even an average household. Maybe just see the way the average American lives, not somebody that's wealthy. I mean, all of us have seen the lives of the super uber wealthy and all that they have. And, you know, sometimes, you know, hey, I wish I had a little bit of that myself, right? But the average American household, when visited by somebody from the third world, jealousy and envy can be a part of that equation. Really can. And then some people get to the point to where if they've done well in life, they get embarrassed by their success. They kind of feel guilty that if they've visited in the third world, they've visited other places. Oh, maybe I shouldn't have so much, or maybe as a Christian I should take a vow of poverty, or maybe I should give everything away. Well, God gave it to you. You don't want to be like Esau, who didn't have regard for his blessing and sold it for a bowl of soup. So since I've understood some of these things, whatever little blessings that I've experienced in life, I give thanks to God for them. I don't feel guilty for them because God gave them to this man, and I'm just one of his descendants. And I've been a very proud descendant of Father Abraham to live in a nation that has been so blessed. And in our territory, I mean, many of us can drive to the border. We can see, you know, part of the third world. There are other parts that, you know, people are successful in other nations, or they have wealth in other nations too, but we're talking about the average person. But if the average person from another country, a very poor, impoverished country, sees what you have or sees what we have, you know, most of us have a car. Many people in the third world do not have vehicles. They just don't live like we do, but I'm not embarrassed by it. I'm just grateful for it. But people can get jealous and envious, as one person recounted to me, that, you know, they see all this wealth in America. And that's kind of, you know, maybe it's good sometimes for people not to come to America, if they're, even if they're servants of God, because you can begin to feel like, wow, why do they have that and we don't? I'm sorry, but I can't apologize for one man being obedient and God deciding to bestow tremendous blessings on that individual. And these blessings have had a profound impact on the United States of America, not just in material wealth, but when you realize the spiritual aspect of this and realize that much of this has come about based on one individual, but it didn't stop with him, because there have been many others through history who have embodied those same ideals of faithfulness and trustworthiness and courage and the ability to step out and the ability to be compassionate, just as Abraham. Take for example, the people that came to this land, the pilgrims, and the people that came to the United States. They certainly gave up a lot. They, like Abraham, left England or left parts of Europe, gathered in Holland, and then sailed across and landed in Massachusetts and suffered incredible hardship and incredible faith that they could come to a place where they could live their lives freely because they didn't like it. And in the same way, Abraham did that. He wasn't going to be bound to the tyranny because it's very likely that he lived very, very close during the time of Nimrod and could have been subject to the tyranny of Nimrod during those early days. So the pilgrims and many of the people who moved to this country or traveled to this country had to move away from their own nation And throughout American history, we see that same spirit. And we see the same type of people that embodied that. They may not have known as much as you do about Abraham, but we see God's hand at work guiding and blessing this nation. It has nothing to do with the obedience of the people at the time. It has a lot to do with what God said he was going to do for this individual and pass down those blessings to Isaac and to Jacob and then to Joseph and then to his sons and so on and so forth. So in the United States and in Great Britain and the colonies of Great Britain, we can see the reflection of the blessings of Abraham even still today. So let's go back to January 1961. As I mentioned, the election was close, but for the good of the nation, I've read several outstanding biographies on President Nixon, one written by Patrick Buchanan, who was not a relation, but also grew up near Washington, D.C., became an aide to President Nixon. In his biography of Nixon, I think it's the greatest comeback, something of that nature. Nixon felt very strongly that he had a case for contesting the election, but he thought if he contested it, it would break the nation apart. It would just not be good. And so you see him in the slide that I showed earlier, in which he is sitting there peaceably and just at the inauguration, and President Kennedy gave the speech and not him. But even prior to that particular inauguration and Kennedy's address and taking over as President of the United States, there was another important speech, and you can look it up. It was given only several days before the inauguration took place. I speak of President Eisenhower's farewell address to the people of the United States. And the thing that is most memorable about, and you can look it up on YouTube, you can find it, the thing that is most memorable about that speech was actually, he didn't realize he was doing it, of course, and I'm not saying it was divine or that it was inspired by God, but it certainly was prophetic because it has come true. He warned the nation of the military-industrial complex that was developing after World War II. And he cited the fact that there were technological interests that also were at play. In other words, he saw within our free system the ability of some individuals to be able to take advantage of that. And what did the military-industrial complex mean? Well, it's also spread into a lot of other industries. But the military-industrial complex that he spoke of were defense contractors, the ability to build a war machine, which is necessary during wartime, but we had had peace. And you think about it, there was only 16 years removed from a world war at that particular time. And as an 8-year-old, you know, I was my birth was 8 years removed from the end of World War II. And some of you are in the same boat or may have been born during that time in the 1940s, and you saw a little bit more of this in the beginning stages. But President Eisenhower was prophetic, and in fact, this is something that President Kennedy in the early part of his presidency really took to heart. And he realized that that warning was spot on, as the British would say. Very early on in President Kennedy's presidency, the Central Intelligence Agency advised him to invade Cuba because there was the threat of communism. Cuba had fallen to the communists several years before. Some of you, if you're movie buffs, if you saw The Godfather, then you remember that that was one of the things that the mob was involved in. In Cuba that's a true story. The mob was involved in Cuba and running the casinos, and then the communists came in, and you know the mob was run out, and so on and so forth. But the CIA advised Kennedy to invade Cuba, and it became known as the Bay of Pigs fiasco, because they recruited certain people who were Cuban nationals living in South Florida to lead this invasion, and then they, for some strange reason, it all went haywire. The air support and everything else was removed. But at any rate, there was a stain on the early presidency of President Kennedy. And as a result, his determination prior to his re-election in 1964 was the abolishment of the CIA. Didn't trust it at all. He was going to grind it to dust and cast it to the four winds. He was also going to withdraw 16,000 advisors in 1963. That's how many advisors, American troops, we had in Vietnam. He was going to bring them all back home. Then after he was assassinated, what happened? More and more war. And that's been the legacy of the United States since that time. Foreign wars and many, I think a lot of people can look back and say, very needless wars. Why? To continue to propagate this military-industrial complex. Yes, a nation has to be safe, and you have to be well-armed in order, in this world, I get it, but Vietnam War began to be escalated, and 60,000 Americans lost their lives, and millions of other people, and a lot of people got rich. Now, I guess we could debate whether or not that was necessary, and the thought was, well, we've got to keep the dominoes of communism from, if one nation falls to communism, then that was the military theory at that particular time. It really didn't work out that way. Communism imploded upon itself, at least for a little while. Even though most people in America weren't alive at the time of the assassination of President Kennedy, 90% of Americans who were alive don't believe the official narrative at that time. And what we saw at the time was what President Eisenhower warned about, and from what I can discern, that is probably the most dramatic fulfillment of a prophecy, and I've touched on that in the last few years. And this is the prophecy that I've come back to time and time again, which I think explains so much about what has happened to our nation. 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 1. But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come. And that's been something we've been aware about for many, many years and wondering. In verse 13 it says, but evil men and impostors will grow worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. One of the arch enemies that Kennedy had, and he made a few of them while he was in office, and his brother made a few too, as the Attorney General of the United States, especially the mob, was an enemy that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. had made because they had helped, according to some, they had helped secure the election of President Kennedy. And Joe Kennedy was aligned with certain interests that some people thought were nefarious, and some people would just outright say that, yeah, he was connected with the mob. So anyway, be that as it is, for delivering Chicago, some people thought that they would have a deal, that they would be soft on crime, but they weren't. They went after the mob like tooth and nail. Evil men and impostors will grow worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. Now, initially, how many of you will remember this? A show of hands, please. The presidency of President Kennedy was called Camelot. Does anybody remember that? And it was named Camelot because it was thought of as an idyllic presidency, a charismatic president, witty, war hero, stories of legend and lore, ascends to the presidency. He's got a beautiful model-like wife, cute little kids. They're very photogenic. They appear on Look and Life magazine. They're the envy of the entire nation. They're the envy of the entire world. They're held up to, I mean, if you could go back, and I would suggest you do this, if you can go back and take a look at President Kennedy's speech in Berlin in June of 1963, the people in West Berlin were going crazy for what he said. The cheers and the roars of the crowd rival any that you have ever heard in any political speech, I would bet. But Camelot was the terminology that was associated because Camelot as a story was an idyllic place where everybody got along and there was justice and there was righteousness and there was happiness because of the leadership. And of course, the Proverbs say that when the righteous lead, the people rejoice, right? Initially, the innocence of Camelot, because of that, no one could believe that an assassination attempt could be carried out from within the United States itself or from within its government. But that's what a lot of people, and most people, believe that that's exactly what happened, that President Kennedy had enemies within his own administration that caused that. I won't go into the details, but I was interested in it even as a 10-year-old and 11-year-old because I witnessed on TV the assassination then in lifetime of Lee Harvey Oswald getting shot as he was being transferred from one jail to the other. I mean, they captured it live. And when I saw that, and then I began, even as a little kid, you know, that cute little guy you saw up there just a little while ago. As a little kid, my mind began to spin and thinking, oh, wait a minute, this guy, they're calling him, the cover story was that he was a great patriot. But then even I could read the newspapers at that particular time, found out that he was a nightclub owner that was, guess what, associated with the mob. Not saying the mob was responsible for his death, but this guy shoots him, somebody that he doesn't know, in broad daylight, where he knows he's going to get caught. I mean, it's the craziest thing. And even I questioned the narrative that this guy was a patriot and he just wanted to avenge the president's death and so on and so forth. But, of course, we'll discuss this in the chat. But at that particular time, the cover story was that it was the Russians that had killed President Kennedy, some elaborate scheme. Oswald had visited in Russia, so that was kind of a convenient, he became kind of a convenient scapegoat because he had lived in Russia, his wife was Russian, et cetera, et cetera. Or it was Castro that was involved in it. And, you know, it was funny that there were successive assassinations with Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy Jr., Bobby Kennedy as well, his brother. And the narrative was that it was always the result of some deranged lone wolf nut. And in fact, everything that didn't hold to that narrative and the results of the Warren Commission, which said that, well, yeah, it looks like Lee Harvey Oswald, he's the guy that did it. It can only have been him. The head of the Warren Commission was an avowed enemy of President Kennedy, so Lyndon Johnson named an avowed enemy of President Kennedy ahead of one of the most important investigations of the government investigating the death of its president, its beloved president. And even though there was an unusually high number of suicides among the witnesses to the Warren Commission, it was found out later, you can look it up, I mean, it's an incredible list of people who committed suicide when they testified before the Warren Commission. Some of them committed suicide in some very strange ways. One person committed suicide by throwing himself through a plate glass window in a department store. You know, just, you know, remember back then, plate glass was plate glass. It was like bulletproof glass. But, you know, hey, here's an effective way. Get, you know, cut in half by 400-pound piece of glass and commit suicide that way. But that was one case, I guess. But anyway, the terminology conspiracy theory was a term that actually was invented by the CIA that came out, and everything was labeled, if it didn't fit with the official narrative of the government at that time, it was labeled a conspiracy theory. We had never heard that term before, never had been a part of American history. But the point of all of this is that if it is the work of evil men, and if that assassination and further assassinations were the result of evil men, they cannot stop the promises of God. So I would say that even though they have canceled the outdoor event for the inauguration on Monday because of weather, cold, cold weather, I would say pray for the inauguration. Because we've seen some weird stuff that has been going on in the last few years. Really, really weird and strange actions. Well, I say they are the work of evil men, but they can't stop the promises of God. God's promises remain steadfast. And in America, we can observe how God has been committed to his word, to Abraham. And he's brought about times and periods in which there are renewal, there are periods of blessing. And I don't know if this is one of those times, but could it possibly be one? I want to make a bold statement here because God has been faithful to honor his covenant with Abraham. And I think that before Christ can return, there are a lot of things that have to happen. You and I are recipients of the Abrahamic blessing. And we have a special responsibility, not just as Americans, but as people of the gospel, to carry forward with that same kind of faithfulness where God leads us. And it should go without saying, but as members of the body of Christ, we have to uphold the same values of righteousness, justice, and compassion, courage that Abraham has. And it really appears for many, I mean, political pundits will say this, that our nation is at a crossroads. Our nation is at the fork in the road. Will we be dominated by what has gone on in the past few years in which we don't have enough money to take care of a few thousand people in Maui, but we've got billions and billions to send to a foreign country to help them, and we know that the individuals don't receive much of that. We live in a nation where a fire can take out a large segment of a metropolitan city and some of the most desired real estate, turn it into a pile of dust, but we don't have the means and the abilities to even fight those fires or prevent them in the first place. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 10, and this is where it really impacts us. We're talking about global events, and we're talking about a small group of people, and we're talking about you as, and me, all of us insignificant individuals, but you know what I'm saying about Abraham's blessings, and you know that this has happened to this country. You know that we just didn't fall into all of these things because of our own merit and even because of our government is better than others or anything else, because you can see evil men through history that try to thwart the promise of God. There's something spiritual that explains all that you have. In Matthew 10 and verse 22, it says, "And you will be hated." That means the disciples of Christ. "You will be hated for my name's sake, but he who endures to the end will be saved. When they persecute you in the city, flee to another. For assuredly, I say to you, you will not have gone through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes." Now, this is a prophecy, or this is a statement that applied to Jesus Christ's disciples. But it is also prophetic in that it applies to the time of the end. At least that's my feeling. And that we won't have enough time to go everywhere in all the cities of Israel, the modern descendants of Israel. We've covered enough times in the last few years. You know who that is. And then turn to Matthew chapter 24 and verse 14, where it says, "This gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come." There will be times of great tribulation following that. In Amos chapter 5 and verse 24, it says, "But let justice run down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream." You know, that will come in the future. That will come with the return of Jesus Christ. And that is the beautiful future that we have to look forward to. When you go back to Abraham's life, and you, if you're in agreement that we live under the blessings of Abraham, and you agree that they're a testament to the power and the of his obedience and his faithfulness of God and God's faithfulness to Abraham, I don't think it's a stretch that you can say that Abraham's journey is kind of like America's journey in the modern world. God has made good on his national birthright blessings. Abraham was a very wealthy man, and he was blessed beyond measure at that particular time, became very, very wealthy. But certainly his progeny and his descendants have become wealthy beyond imagination. Now, I think sometimes in the past, when we have seen difficulties encompass the nation, I'm meaning as a body, as a church, as students of prophecy, as looking at what has happened, and I will admit that I've been in the same category. I have been, so I'm not going to include you, but I have been very quick to say that it looks like God is removing his blessings from the descendants of Abraham. Is that assumption or presumption on my part actually correct? Or have we seen at various times in our history the result of the work of very evil men who seemingly get away with their wicked deeds? You may not agree with the fact or the idea that somebody other than Lee Harvey Oswald is the one that shot President Kennedy, but the reason I bring this up is that this nation changed at that particular time. It went through a period of mourning, and sure, it picked itself back up. But at what cost? An incredible increase in what President Eisenhower warned the nation about. A fulfilled human prophecy, if you will. And we've been like that with brief respites. Good leaders, President Nixon was eventually elected. A lot of people don't know this. He became one of the most popular presidents in history. Landslide wins. Incredible popularity. Until Watergate, another story that you can go down a lot of rabbit holes in through. I think sometimes we may have seen the removal of God's blessing as a fulfillment of prophecy, the aspect of Leviticus 26, you know, the blessings and the cursings chapter, Deuteronomy 28. But maybe it wasn't the removal of the blessing God gave to Abraham. Maybe it was the interruption in our lives of the work of evil men in fulfillment of what Paul told Timothy, motivated by their father, the devil. And there are people that are evil enough to do that. And I think you have to have the courage to understand that and embrace it and realize that Paul said in Ephesians 2 that the spirit of this world, which is the prince of the power of the air, has his greatest effect in the sons of disobedience. And the sons of disobedience, being motivated by their father, the devil, can do a lot of damage. So I'm not sure that God has totally removed his blessings from his people. And that's good, because that might make a great environment for the people of God to finish the proclamation of the gospel. And so that's why I encourage you to pray for our president, pray for the protection of everyone gathered in Washington for a few days, because there's all kinds of scary things out there. And let's commit ourselves to the same kind of path of righteousness that Abraham walked, so that we can partake in the same kind of blessings and enjoy them. I hope that the next 4 years will be filled with some great differences than we've had in the last 4 years. But there are some evil men out there that, for whatever reason or whatever their motivation, They'd like to throw a spanner in the works, as the British like to say. So let's reflect and pray about the last words that Jesus gave to his disciples before he ascended. It's a collective job and task that I believe has been given to the disciples of Jesus Christ. And we all have to ask ourselves, even though you're just an individual sitting out there and I'm just an individual, are you fully committed? Are you fully invested in this? In Matthew chapter 28 and verse 18, imagine the thrill of being there as Jesus is addressing his disciples for the last time. After everything that they had been through for 3 years, and after everything they had been through in the last 40 days, and he's saying goodbye. Jesus came and spoke to them, saying, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and earth. I'm telling you, go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things that I have commanded you, and lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age."